This is a session of the 1st of April. Today we're going to talk about philosophy of the 19th century. First, before we go into that, I should give you some feedback about the philosophy of the 19th century and about the global historical context. Now, the 19th century is known in the West as the heyday of the conquerors, the colonialists, the industrialists, the inventors, and the bankers. It was also a period of population growth and rapid urbanization. If you look at the population of the Netherlands, for instance, we go from a rather relatively small population of 2 million at the beginning of the 19th century to almost more than double that number, namely 5 million inhabitants, at the end of the 19th century. For Belgium, it's more or less the same. Belgium was a bit more densely populated. At the beginning, there were already 3 million of inhabitants, but also it goes to 5 million at the end of the 19th century. This is not just a number. It also entails consequences on the social level, on the cultural level. These developments also entailed an increasing literacy, for example, of the population. For the first time in history, education and culture were no longer the privilege of a small social elite. Around 1800, only half of all Dutch children could attend primary school. But that figure had risen to over 90% at the turn of the 20th century. It was the printing industry that played an important role in making mass culture possible, because this is what is emerging here, mass culture. Now, since Gutenberg in the 15th century, printing and publishing had been carried out in almost the same way for over 400 years. And now, the 19th century saw an enormous increase in scale in the printing industry, thanks to a host of industrial innovations. These include, for instance, the paper-making machine, steam-powered printing press, the rotary press, and lithography. These technological innovations made it possible for newspaper circulation to grow from several hundred copies to several thousand. By 1814, using new equipment, such as rotary press, the Times of London, one of the most famous and largest newspapers in the world, could print all 7,000 newspaper copies that they needed in one night. By the end of the century, the first illustrated textbooks appeared. The number of printers and publishers increased dramatically. Paper consumption in the most literate countries, such as England, the Netherlands, Belgium, grew by a factor of 10. The new mass culture also brought the masses to the fore of political and economic thought. This century saw the emergence of demography, political economy, and sociology as new areas of science. Thinkers such as David Ricardo, John Stuart Mill, Auguste Comte, and Karl Marx continued the scientific project initiated by Adam Smith in the previous century. Already in the early 19th century, philosophy was clearly changing. Society was increasingly seen as an autonomous system with its own dynamics, functioning independently of the thinking or the desires of the individual. The German philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel used the massive political changes of his own time, in particular the Napoleonic Wars, as the basis for his influential philosophy of history. According to Hegel, art, too, can be better understood as part of a historical process. And he is the first thinker I would like to present in the context of this chapter. So let me dive into Hegel's philosophy of history a bit more. In order to understand Georg Wilhelm Friedrich correctly, we need to understand the historical context in which he lived. And that context, beginning of the 19th century, is largely synonymous with the name of one man, Napoleon Bonaparte. Hegel was born in 1770, so he was 19 years old when the French Revolution broke out. European intellectuals, artists, and progressive politicians responded with a wave of enthusiasm. It finally seemed that the dream of the Enlightenment, to reform, or maybe even to do away with the old political order based on tradition and faith, was becoming a real possibility. Hegel would later write in a characteristic high-sounding way, and I quote, "All thinking beings shared in the jubilation of this epoch," end of quote. When Hegel received the news of the French Revolution, he went out, together with some friends, to plant a liberty tree as a symbol of the hopes sown by the revolution. Or you can also think of the words of a romantic poet such as William Wordsworth. He said, and I quote again, "Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. To identify yourself as a young man with this new emerging young era, this era of hope, of progress, of enlightenment, was very heaven," according to Wordsworth. The revolution ended in bloody violence and civil war, but many of these same intellectuals saw Napoleon as the one who could rescue the ideals of the revolution: liberty, equality, fraternity, and export them to the other European countries through his military victories. This was especially the case for Hegel. You could say that Napoleon, for Hegel, is a philosophical figure, even more than a political figure. He is an icon, like a symbol, something to think about, something, a central figure of his philosophy. So you can imagine the young German thinker viewed the reign of Napoleon in that same positive way. Now, you should know that Napoleon's grip on Europe was not only of great military and political significance, but brought also fundamental changes to the social order. His victories, for instance, exported the new French political culture, based on a strong central authority, which promulgated uniform rules for the entire territory, including the civil code and the metric system. Maybe I should tell you something more about the civil code. The civil code is also called the Napoleonic Code. This was actually the first modern legal code to be adopted, which was valid for all of Europe, which had a pan-European scope. This was quite unique. Actually, the last time that this had been something of possibility was Roman antiquity. The Romans had done something similar. And meanwhile, this had never been possible again, and now it became possible through the conquests of Napoleon. So, these developments inspired Hegel to an exalted description of Napoleon when he was entering the university town of Jena. Jena, it's a town in Germany, it's where Hegel was studying, and it's also coincidentally the place where Napoleon scored his definitive victory over Prussia during the Napoleonic Wars. When Hegel saw Napoleon's army entering the town of Jena, he wrote the following, and I quote, "The emperor, this world soul, I saw riding through the city to review his troops. It is indeed a wonderful thing to see such an individual who, here concentrated into a single point, sitting on a horse, reaches out over the world and dominates it." End of quote. This is why Hegel is best known as a political thinker and a philosopher of history. Based on the historical events of his own time, Hegel arrived at the conviction that history is not meaningless. There is a direction in history. There is something meaningful about history. There is real progress. Now, earlier thinkers, such as Immanuel Kant, had been much more skeptical about that. According to Kant, for instance, you could deduce from the philosophical analysis of human nature that humankind was already finished, that history was real, things were changing, wars were happening, kings were changing, and so on, but it didn't change anything fundamental to human nature. So history could never produce anything truly new, according to Kant. And Hegel would disagree with this. Now, let me first stay with the old philosophy of history, this old vision on history which held that history could never produce anything really new. It's actually best to summarize this vision using the words of Macbeth. Macbeth is a theater play by Shakespeare, of course, and in Macbeth there's this beautiful passage where Macbeth becomes aware of the meaninglessness of time in his situation. He's at the height of his power, but simultaneously he sees that he has murdered his king before, but he will have to kill again and again and again. And every day will be the same paranoia, the same fear for being betrayed. And he comes to the awareness that time has become empty and meaningless for him. He says, history is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. End of quote. Now, let's call this the nihilistic position. There is no meaning to be found in history. But if you disagree with that position, if you believe that history is meaningful, like Hegel did, there are nevertheless multiple possibilities of how history can be meaningful. And Hegel chooses one particular position of those, of all those possible positions. Let me show you the alternatives first. I think this is important in order to better understand what was unique to Hegel's position. Now, these are some of the alternatives. You can believe that there is a sense in history, a direction, but be agnostic about that. Agnostic means you know that you don't know. So here in the agnostic position, you say, yes, history has a meaning, but we as human beings are too limited to see it, to understand it. We cannot know it. It is hidden to us. Of course, practically speaking, this position is not very different from the nihilistic position of Macbeth. Let's go on. Secondly, you have the theological position. Here you say history has a meaning, and we as humans can know that meaning. We know where history is going, but we cannot change it. It's the position that you have in a number of religions. For instance, when you believe in divine providence. Let me take Christianity as an example. In Christian theology, it is believed that history is meaningful, but this has already been fully decided by God. For instance, Christians believe that history has started, of course, with the creation of the world. And then you have had a number of important events, which are narrated in the Old Testament and the New Testament. There is a crucial moment when Christ dies at the cross. That's a breaking point in history. And then there's another new breaking point that's coming, which is the return of Christ at the end of times, the apocalypse, Judgment Day, as predicted in the Revelation of John. So for Christians, there is a historical scheme, there is a historical diagram. Time has its course, history will have its course, and there is an endpoint that we are going towards to. But we cannot change that endpoint. It's moving forward whatever we do. God has decided already upon it. Now, the theological position is different again from the third option, and that is the modern position, as I will call it. It's the modern position of Hegel. Not all modern philosophers agree with this, but still a number of contemporary political philosophers do. And here you say, history has a meaning. We as human beings can identify that meaning. We can understand the meaning of history, but we can also contribute to it. Humans are not limited. They are not powerless, historically speaking. They can contribute to how history will evolve through their political actions. For instance, a good example of this is the view of many Western politicians of the last 50 years, especially in America, but also in Europe, who believe that it's valuable and it's necessary for Western politicians to spread Western moral and political values. Democracy, for instance, liberalism, political freedoms, economic liberalism. One philosopher who has advocated this position is the American philosopher Francis Fukuyama. He wrote a famous book about this, which is called The End of History and the Last Man. So if you want to see what philosophy of history can mean today in our current political situation, I would advise you to have a look at Fukuyama, at his book, The End of History and the Last Man. Now, the modern position was actually first introduced and elaborated by Hegel. He is at the root of the modern position. He is the philosopher who first introduced it and developed it. Hegel believed that human nature itself was subject to historical change. The historical process has a direction, and that direction is meaningful. As humans, we can make our own contribution to history. Now, Hegel was not alone with this insight, although he is certainly the most famous for it. Other people too, contemporaries of Hegel, saw the world actively changing around them during their own lifetimes. For instance, if you were born in London at the end of the 18th century, you would be living in one of the largest cities of the world. But still, it was a city that contained less than 1 million of inhabitants. Now, during your lifetime, you would see this population strongly increase. You would see the city overflowing. There would be many people coming into the city. The city would be expanded. The city would expand and take over the surrounding countryside. At the end of your life, let's say in the 1860s, you would notice that the population of London had tripled to more than 3 million of inhabitants. And your children would see it increase even more, up to 6 million at the start of the 20th century. So there's an exponential growth here. It's growing exponentially fast. Obviously, this changes the city a lot, but also changes you as a human being. You become aware that you are witnessing history happening during your own lifetime. The face of the world is changing during your own life. And this is new. Previous generations had never experienced this kind of world-changing development. History simply went much slower in previous centuries. You could not see the face of the world changing so fast. It was something that happened over multiple generations, not one lifetime, one generation, which is what is happening now. So, a new historical consciousness is emerging during the 19th century. We have a beautiful visual example of this in the work of Edward Quinn. Now, Edward Quinn was a British historian, and he produced one of the very first historical atlases. You might have used this in secondary school, maybe in high school before. A historical atlas is an atlas, of course. It shows you maps of the world, of pieces of the world. But the historical atlas shows you the map as it looked like in previous times. Now, the historical atlas produced by Edward Quinn was called a historical atlas in a series of maps of the world as known at different periods. He published it in the year 1830, coincidentally, the year that Belgium was founded. Now, this book is a marvelous work because Quinn has tried to visualize, and this is the contribution of the book is actually on the level of the graphic design. He has tried to visualize how much smaller the world was to previous generations of human beings. And the visual solution that he found for this problem is quite ingenious. What he does is he always draws the map of the world at the same size. First one page of the book, and then in later chapters, a double page, a full spread, when to account for the discovery of the Americas. But on this page, he obscures the parts that were not yet discovered. And he does this using black clouds. You can find examples of this in the slides. So what you see as you leaf through the book is that the world is consistently becoming larger. The darkness is uncovered until we arrive at the time of Napoleon, the time when Edward Quinn himself lived, and we see that the world has now been fully discovered. The darkness has fully disappeared. Of course, there is something terribly naive and Eurocentric about Quinn's visualizations, as if the world only starts to exist when it is discovered, quote-unquote, by Europeans. But still, it gives you an insight in how historical consciousness is growing and developing during this period. So, Let me now go back to Hegel's view. When Hegel is looking at history from a philosophical perspective, he also sees meaningful development. He calls it the realization through history of the Spirit, Geist in German. What Geist means for Hegel is rational self-consciousness. In this regard, he is still an Enlightenment philosopher. He comes very late. He develops his work after Romanticism, but the spirit of the Enlightenment is still very much there in his work. Humans, for Hegel, stand much higher than lifeless matter because they can freely decide who they are. The history of the world can therefore be understood as the growing development of the consciousness of freedom. Let me quote Hegel on this: "The history of the world is none other than the progress of the consciousness of freedom." End of quote. Please mind that Hegel does not write the progress of freedom. He writes the progress of the consciousness of freedom. He does acknowledge that freedom itself has very much increased since the days of antiquity. But he specifically wants to pinpoint that as humans, what has even more changed is how we have become conscious of our increasing freedoms. Now, in the Oriental cultures of the ancient world, such as ancient Egypt, ancient Assyria, Hegel observes that both practical freedom and the consciousness of freedom were incredibly limited. Only one individual, the supreme leader, the pharaoh, the emperor, the patriarch, was a really free individual, and all the others had to subordinate their wills to him. These social relations were also anchored socially and mentally, as, for example, through a caste system. This is what Hegel meant by a lack of the consciousness of freedom. Existence in such a society is not merely unfree, but also implies the acceptance of unfreedom as a fact of nature. Thus, for Hegel, these societies were a dead end. According to Hegel, they did not allow any real historical development. Only in ancient Greece had the consciousness of individual freedom come to the surface. On a political level, that freedom had been at the basis of the Persian Wars. However, the freedom of the individual was not yet fully developed. For instance, the Greeks combined their idea of freedom with the social acceptance of slavery. Moreover, Greek citizens were also not completely free, and that was because they always understood their freedom as a fact of nature. I am free because I am a citizen of the city of Athens, and in Athens, citizens are free. That was how freedom was defined. It was by virtue of your city allowing you freedom, as was the case in Athens, but not in all other Greek cities. This was not, according to Hegel's analysis, a rationally founded concept of freedom. It was not seen as a fundamental right of every human individual. No, you had to have the luck to be born in Athens. If you were born in a different city, say Corinth or Sparta, your freedoms would be much more limited. And that was just like that. That was just a fact of nature. Live with it. Under the Roman Empire, the naturally given freedom of the Greeks developed into an abstract notion of individual freedom. So the Romans did have a notion of the freedom of every human being, and this was also consolidated in law. However, for 90% of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire, it remained an abstract freedom, because practically speaking, it was very well possible to be free in abstracto and yet living your life as a slave or a prisoner of war. Now, as you see, I'm progressing from Egyptian antiquity to Greek antiquity to Roman antiquity, and in this way, Hegel goes on. He surveys the entire political history of the West. It's like a political history of Western Europe that he is writing, and he shows in every situation how the sense of freedom is manifesting itself ever more brightly. Ultimately, it leads to late modern Western European society, where the political, the religious, and the economic freedom of each individual is guaranteed. Now, the German philosopher is very much aware that not all people of his own time can truly enjoy this freedom. He is well aware, he's not naive, he's aware of repression, he's aware of censorship, of social injustice, of the bloodshed happening during the Napoleonic Wars. For instance, during the period of French power in Germany, when Napoleon had not yet been defeated, I'm talking now about the period between 1806 and 1814, there had happened a period of reform in Germany, political reform. Censorship, for instance, censorship of the press was lifted. But as soon as Napoleon suffered his final defeat in Waterloo in 1815, these reforms were actually turned back. In 1819, all the German states agreed to censor newspapers and periodicals again, to start doing that again, and to adopt repressive measures against those who advocated revolutionary ideas. So we can have a revolution moving freedom forward and then a counter-revolution taking us back again in time. Hegel acknowledged this. Hegel knew that history was messy business. But still, he believed that these setbacks were merely rearguard actions when considered against the larger scheme of history. Humanity as a whole, for Hegel, is definitely on its way to a full realization of human freedom. So far, I've been discussing Hegel's political philosophy, his philosophy of history. Now, let's have a look at his philosophy of art. Hegel's philosophy of art was developed during the final stage of his life. As a professor in Berlin, he was enjoying great fame. And he lectured on the topic of aesthetics, philosophy of art, 5 times over a period of 10 years. So it was clearly for him, as a ripe philosopher, as a mature philosopher, it was clearly an interesting topic. After his unexpected death in 1831, due to a cholera epidemic, these lectures were edited by one of his students and published. The most conspicuous aspect of Hegel's aesthetics is undoubtedly its rationalism. Just like religion and philosophy, art is a product of the human mind, an attempt to unveil the mystery of the world. Therefore, the task of the philosopher of art is nothing less than the systematic and scientific explanation of the history of art. The importance of personal taste, irrational preferences, or of healthy terror, all the important topics of the romanticist aesthetics, have now disappeared. A scientific approach to art is not only possible, Hegel believes, it's also necessary. Only the philosophy of art can bring to light the true meaning of art. It thus becomes evident that art today means something different than in previous historical periods. While works of art have long articulated the highest possible understanding of the world, now they no longer achieve this. Science and philosophy have taken over that role. In the introduction to his lectures, Hegel says the following, and I quote, "The peculiar nature of artistic production and of works of art no longer fills our highest need. We have got beyond venerating works of art as divine and worshipping them. The impression they make is of a more reflective kind, and what they arouse in us needs a higher touchstone and a different test. Thought and reflection have spread their wings above fine art." End of quote. So the role of art in human history, however important it may have been, has now come to an end. Art has been outflanked, so to speak, or overwinged by thought and reflection. That diagnosis fits into Hegel's dialectical vision of the development of human culture. Now, dialectics means that opposing forces first collide. You have a thesis, you have an antithesis, and there's a conflict between these two. And then in the next stage, they annul each other, they cancel each other out in order to arrive at the next step. There's a synthesis. The thesis and the antithesis fuse in a new synthesis. And this synthesis becomes the next step. It becomes a thesis again. There's a new antithesis. And again, you have this fusion, this Aufhebung, as Hegel calls it, Aufhebung. There's no good English translation for this. Aufhebung is when two opposing forces clash and there is no clear winner and no clear loser, but rather the two forces are surmounted or lifted, or they are merged in some way, fused and becoming transformed into something else. Okay. So previously art was the medium where such contradictions could find expression. Today, Hegel says, humanity has arrived at a deeper understanding of these contradictions, especially in Hegel's own field, philosophy. Now, the diagnosis of the end of art does not mean that Hegel did not appreciate the arts. On the contrary, he was a very fond visitor of museums, of the opera, of the theater. Actually, Hegel considers the art to be a sensory expression of human freedom. But the fact remains that art will always be subordinated to the rational expression of that freedom through philosophy or through religion. You might call that a rather pessimistic view of contemporary art. It does not diminish the fact that he delivers fascinating insights into the historical genres of art. And that applies especially well to the genres he discusses lastly in his book, namely tragic drama and comic drama. He focuses primarily on the tragedies and comedies of ancient Greece. This is something that he has in common with many German writers and philosophers of his day. There you have this typical romantic fascination of German intellectuals with Greek drama and Greek culture in general. Now, what is original for Hegel and surprising is that not tragedy, but comedy for him has the highest artistic significance. Let me begin by paraphrasing what he says about tragedy. Tragedy, says Hegel, is about the elimination or the reconciliation of opposites. As a spectator, I am witnessing a clash between different ethical powers. Let me quote Hegel himself on this. The conflict is produced by the ethical justification of both sides, not by an evil will or any sheer misfortune. End of quote. If we have true evil at play or we have misfortune at play, then you get something else. Then you get melodrama or tragic comedy, modern genres. No. When it's truly about tragedy, the tragic in the pure sense of the word, there is both sides of the conflict are ethically justified. Let me give you an example of that, because it sounds probably quite abstract. His most elaborately discussed example is that of the tragedy of Antigone by Sophocles. I hope you know this play. Antigone is one of the most famous Greek tragedies. It's a beautiful theater play. For me, it's one of the great works of literature. It's one of the great legacies of the Greeks that we have left today, that have survived until today. Now, the play Antigone tells us the story of the civil war in the ancient Greek city of Thebes after the death of Oedipus. Oedipus, you will surely already have heard of. Let me briefly sketch the story. So Oedipus has two sons. Their names are Ithiocles and Polynices, and he also has two daughters, namely Antigone and Ismene. After the death of Oedipus, there is a conflict between the two brothers about who will become the new king. And in order to find a solution, they decide to share the power. Each of them will reign for 1 year, and so they will take turns, giving over power from one brother to the other and returning it. Of course, it goes wrong. After the first year already, Ithiocles decides that he does not want to share power. The other brother, Polynices, goes into alliances with other cities and he wages war against Thebes. During the battle, the two brothers fight and they kill each other simultaneously. This is the situation at the start of the play Antigone. So after the civil war between the sons of Oedipus, the question arises, what should be done with the bodies of the dead brothers who have slain one another? Creon, who is the new ruler and the brother of Oedipus, decides that Eteocles is to be buried with all due honors. After all, he was the king of Thebes. But Creon also prohibits the burial of Polynices, the other brother, because he attacked the city. And so the corpse of Polynices must remain outside of the city walls, and there it is to be eaten by wild animals. Now, the sister of Eteocles and Polynices, Antigone, one of the sisters, cannot accept this. And in her discussions with Creon, she emphasizes the religious duty that we have to bury both brothers with the appropriate ceremonies. Polynices should be buried. So she resists Creon's prohibition on the burial of her brother. And eventually, she is also convicted for this. She is arrested and convicted for stepping up, for violating the prohibition that Creon had installed. She will have to pay for her obstinacy with her own death. At the end of the play, Antigone is buried alive. It's a tragic drama, of course. Now, what is so valuable about it, what's so fascinating about the story and about the way that Sophocles is telling it, is that it shows us in full force the irreconcilability of the conflict, which, while simultaneously aiming at a new ethical equilibrium. During his lectures on aesthetics in 1823, Hegel expressed it as follows, and I quote, this is a longer quote, "In this drama, Creon, the power of the state, is acting against the family. He punishes Antigone, and he offends against piety. In doing so, he harms himself. His son, Haemon, betrothed to Antigone, dies with her. By the harm he inflicts, the king therefore harms himself. By the same token, Antigone, a citizen of the state, acts against the state, and this offense likewise harms her and brings about her death. The offending aspect is in each of the two sides themselves, and it harms the individuals in themselves. This is the consummate way of ending. As for the ending itself, it must be reconciling, affirmative. It must be an ethical equilibrium, the equal validity of two powers that must come into view. Both sides are in the wrong, and they come to be posited in unity by the fact that they come into harmony. This truly satisfies the heart ethically. The heart is touched by the individuals and reconciled in the matter. This reconciliation is objective when it exists only for us, objectively, and not for the one-sided individuals. There is this kind of reconciliation in Antigone. Here, the audience has the satisfaction that the resolution has taken place inherently in the matter itself." End of quote. So you see what happens with this opposition, this irreconcilable opposition in the case of tragedy. Now the situation will be very different for comedy. Comedy still has the same starting point as tragedy. There is a conflict of opposites, albeit not so much between ethical powers as between different subjectivities. Nor is the conflict resolved at the expense of the destruction of a character. You don't have to pay for your mistakes with your life in a comedy. You pay by being ridiculed, by becoming the laughingstock. Nor is the, a true comedy, according to Hegel, is about characters who can transcend the conflict because they do not take themselves too seriously. Hegel insisted that such comedies were quite rare that could not be found on the stages of his own time. In most comedies by his contemporaries, the characters of the play are ridiculed only by the public. They do not laugh at themselves. They are not coming, in other words, to comic self-consciousness. He seeks the true comic spirit elsewhere, namely in the old comedy from the 5th century before the Common Era. We also call this Attic Old Comedy because we only have examples coming from Attica, which is the area around Athens. We know this genre of theater, Attic Old Comedy, mainly through the work of the Athenian dramatist Aristophanes. In his lectures, Hegel discusses Strepsiades and Socrates, the protagonists of the play The Clouds, produced in 423 before the Common Era. The play ridicules the Greek philosopher Socrates, under his own name, as a charlatan, as an imposter. But the character himself, the character of Socrates, on stage, is also fully aware of this. He laughs at himself, he ridicules himself, he fully participates in his own comic demise. In the work of Aristophanes, the characters are comical not only for the spectators, but also for themselves. They have an outspoken opinion about the political situation and the social situation in Athens, but at the same time, their own behavior compromises that opinion. The example of the sex strike in the play Lysistrata from 411 before the Common Era is quite illuminating. Let me tell you what Lysistrata is about. So together with women from the other cities, the Athenian woman Lysistrata wants to protest against the ongoing war in Greece. The woman's main weapon is to deny the men any sexual favor. Simultaneously, they occupy the Acropolis and the treasury, national treasury, comes under female management. Soon, however, it turns out that the strikers themselves are quite a motley crew. The women are portrayed as lazy, they're often drunk, or they want to drink, and moreover, they're just as eager for sex as the Greek men. And so eventually, out of sheer physical distress and sexual frustration, both groups ultimately agree to a peace treaty. And so the women actually are successful, they get their peace. There is another play by Aristophanes which I would like to briefly mention. It's a play in which a farmer is also tired of the war in Greece, and he decides, he has another solution for that problem. He decides to fly to heaven, Mount Olympus in the ancient Greek mythology, seated on a dung beetle. He has this huge beetle, this huge scarab, so a dung beetle, and he uses it to fly to the gods in order to ask them to make peace. Only problem is, nobody's home on Mount Olympus except the god of war, of who he is, of course, afraid, the farmer. But eventually the farmer finds the goddess of peace. She's also there, and she just happens to be a beautiful naked woman. So he takes her with him on the back of his beetle, and they have a big celebration when they come. They come back to Athens, and he marries her, and he has his peace. So, as you see, you can never take the characters of Aristophanes really seriously. They're just, it's absurd what happens, the plots, the characters. Everything is so ridiculous, and yet it works. There is an American translator of Aristophanes by the name of Jeffrey Henderson, who has very aptly summarized Hegel's view, how you can look at Aristophanes with the eyes of Hegel. And Jeffrey Henderson writes the following, and I quote, "The salvation of the polis that we see presented on stage is a comic utopia founded by grotesque caricatures who are themselves targets of comic exposure." So the highest degree of comedy consists in not taking one's own seriousness too seriously. Let me, to conclude this session, quote Hegel himself on this topic. We have already remarked that comedy is fundamentally that with which tragedy comes to an end. The cheerful heart is absolutely reconciled within itself. The heart that entangles itself produces an antithesis, seeks to alleviate the entanglement, but is so inept in its measures that it undercuts its own aims by these measures, although in doing so it remains calm and certain of itself. This is on the whole the concept of classical comedy as we find it in the plays of Aristophanes. With comedy, we must discern whether the characters are comical for the participants or just comical for us. In Molière's plays and Spanish plays, we see individuals who have a goal. They pursue their goal in mutual opposition and undercut them, often independently of one another. This is comical to us, whereas each individual is in bitter earnest. Only a few, particularly the servants, are the ones who make fun of the aims of both sides. The servants occupy the audience's perspective. Theirs are the humorous roles. But at the same time, they are often spiteful. We see very upright people acting disgracefully. Often, hostile interests pervade the whole. Genuine comedy, in contrast, is the heart's absolute freedom, and Aristophanes conveys it to us. His figures are fundamentally on the mark. They are the ones who undermine their own purposes, and they are quite content in doing this. So that, with this very undermining, it comes to light that they are not in earnest about these purposes. Aristophanes especially held the Athenian people itself up to ridicule. The foolishness of the people and its statesmen are the special topics of Aristophanes' comedies, in which he proves to be the best of citizens because this was not merely a joking matter for him. He portrays in their foolishness the deeds of the statesman who establish a purpose but undermine it in carrying it out. He has therefore made the roles inherently comical, such that the characters are fools from the outset. Here, therefore, we see a completely self-assured subjectivity that, in the foundering of its aims, always remains what it is. End of quote. Thank you very much. Hope to see you again after the Easter break.